Have you ever read or seen a film, read a book or seen a film where there's a character that's referred to throughout the book or the film, and yet you don't really meet with them? I was struck very much recently, Tracy and I watched the famous film, which is based on Graham Greene's book, The Third Man. And this character called Harry Lime, who everyone talks about throughout the film, memorably played by Orson Welles, but you don't see him until about two-thirds of the film has gone. But he dominates everything that's going on. It's all about his friend trying to find him. He's supposed to be dead, but is he dead? There seems to be evidence he's alive, and eventually he is revealed in a memorable scene, and you start to see what all the fuss was about as to why everyone was referring to him and why the plot revolves around him. Well, we've not had a dissimilar situation here. Solomon, way back at the beginning of the book, in chapter 1, verses 12 to 13... he said he was going to look at everything being guided by wisdom. He was going to literally let wisdom be his teacher. He was going to let it rule the day as he looked at various things that were going on, as he looked at life in a sin-damaged world. But although he's referred to wisdom, he hasn't actually spent a lot of time looking at it. Yes, it's been the means by which he's come to his conclusions, but that's about it so far. So now he decides he wants to take a closer look at wisdom. And Solomon has really got three points as he considers wisdom. And the first one is this: wisdom is very important. And it's good to look to the places, or to be in the places, that make us consider wisdom. Well, what do I mean? Well, putting it rather bluntly, Solomon's saying there's more point in going to a funeral than to a party, which might seem a bit surprising. Wouldn't be our immediate choice if we were confronted, what would you rather go to? Would you rather go to a funeral or to go to a party? I think we'd all know which one we'd decide we'd want to go to. We'd want to go to the party, wouldn't we? But just listen to Solomon's case, because he's going to make a very powerful case in the first few verses of chapter 7. Rather interesting, he starts with something that would have been considered very, very precious in the ancient Near East. And that is a fine perfume. In fact, that would have been seen as very precious. To have such lotions would have shown you had great wealth. They weren't, cheap in those days. They would have conferred the fact that you had status. But actually, he says in the end, for all that tells people about you, far better to have a name that's well sort of recognised. Far better that people think good of you. Now the rubber really hits the road in verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. As I said, better to go to a funeral than a party. But why does he say that? Well, he says it because he wants us to reflect. And he realises that half the time, laughter gets in the way of reflection. I can remember a friend. He was a bit of a sort of mixed character in his temperament, so I'm not actually convinced by this, but he once said that when he was younger, he was having so much fun, the days just blended into one into another. Now, that in a sense does tell us something, doesn't it? That everything is sort of so quickly gained, quickly lost, quickly passed by, that you don't really reflect for long. As I said, I'm not quite convinced of that from what I know of him. But there is a sense in that, isn't there? If we're just looking to have a great time all the time, if we're looking to have a laugh, let's face it, we don't reflect on anything too deeply, do we? What does Solomon say? Well, death at least makes you think, doesn't it? Verse 2, for death is the destiny of every man. The living should take this to heart. You know, there's often a case, isn't it, that death makes philosophers of us all when we lose someone close in the family. We start to think more deeply, don't we? The heart of the wise, verse 4, is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of pleasure. Now, there is a sense, I think, in this that Solomon is using a common Jewish device. He's using extremes to make a point. I don't think he was saying, you know, basically be sad all the time and you'll get so much more out of life. I think he's saying, he's making the point is this. If you just want to just fill your head with empty notions, then your head will remain fairly empty, won't it? But far better to be reflective. Far better to realise that in the end, that mourning, death, these are things that we will all count with. One of the things I'm very conscious with, just having had a birthday, is that there's far less years ahead than there are behind, a lot less. That tends to sort of make me think, as a pastor particularly, how do I spend them? What do I do? What should I be doing? See, there's just that little sort of reflection when another birthday passes. And I think, well, 1 year less. What should I be doing with what's ahead? It does make us reflective, doesn't it? You see, in the end, as the example I used in the children's talk is thorns and stuff may sort of appear to make a good fire, but in the end they don't produce any real heat. If you were looking in your camping trip to get a fire going, they will sound impressive, but they won't heat up your meal, which is what you so desperately need after a hard day's walking or whatever you've been doing. So the laughter of fools is meaningless. Now, as I said, that does not mean Solomon has a down on laughter. He said there's a place for it. Chapter 3, verse 4. A time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. Dance, yes, there are extremes in life. And you can sort of realise that there are times to be sad. There inevitably in this life there will be times to be sad. Things we see on the news sadden us. Loss in the family sadden us. Illness in the family sadden us. But there are some good times as well, as Solomon has noted throughout. There are times when we can take real joy in what this life gives us or what it presents us with. But don't get obsessed with the good time. In the end, it's like a fire that produces no heat. And so Solomon concludes, so the laughter of fools, this too is meaningless. And again, we got that phrase, meaningless, Hebel, it's like a mist. It's something you can't catch on to, it's sort of like a vapour. It looks solid when you see it, but there's no substance to it. Far better to think about things carefully. Verse 8, the end of the matter is better than the beginning, and patience is better than pride. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Think about things very carefully. Why? Because actually, sometimes when we've been through a time, now, he doesn't say what kind of time it is, and I think it's quite important, this, the end of the matter being the beginning. Whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, it is good to get to the end of it. If it's good, we can look back on it and reflect at the good or the blessings of God in the fact that we've, whatever it is we're rejoicing. It may be our home, it may be our family. It may be a job well done, who knows. When we look back, and if we look back in the right attitude, there's much to be gained. If it's been bad, then there's still a sense, isn't it? We've come through it. We've been preserved through it. We may have even learnt something by it, which is very much what Solomon's been saying earlier in this passage. In the end, think about things carefully. Don't be too hasty about anything. Verse 9, don't be provoked in spirit. Don't be a slave to your passions. That's like being a fool again, isn't it? And don't, you know, look back too much anyway. Yes, there's something about being thankful for previous days. If a church has a fine tradition where the Bible's been preached, yes, by all means look back. But actually looking back at the past won't actually do anything for the cause of the gospel in Stony Stratford, will it? It's about the here and now, whether the church is in its glory days or not. Don't look back. It's not wise to ask such questions, Solomon said. In the end, be content. He notes in verse 11 and 12 that wisdom is like an inheritance. It's a good thing. It's like a shelter. Knowledge can sometimes avoid difficult things. It can sometimes save someone from making a bad decision. As he says, verse 12, second part, wisdom preserves the light of its possessor. And in the end, you can't change what God has ordained. Verse 13 and 14. Consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. When times are bad, consider God has made one as well as the other. Therefore, man cannot discover anything about his future. Do you know, I'm actually very, very, very happy that I do not know what the future holds. And the reason for that is sometimes when I look at ministry particularly, and I think of some of the things that happen, I think I probably wouldn't have opted for it in the first place. God keeps us blissfully ignorant at times, doesn't he? And the other thing, it's in his hands, isn't it? Whether we face good or bad, are we going to commit those times to him? That's the key thing. Do we look at them in relation to our walk with him? Because that's the big problem, isn't it? Often we don't. I can remember a fellow minister, had a teenage daughter, and he was talking about his teenage daughter and how she was making strides in her faith. But he said she's still got the same attitude. You know, the attitude she needs to sort of start to come to grips with is, things are going well, God loves me. Things are going badly, God hates me. Brothers and sisters, she's not the only one, is she? Aren't we all a bit susceptible to that? Shouldn't we, like Job, accept whatever comes from the hand of God and seek him in it rather than sort of seeing it as proof of his love or proof of his lack of care? So Solomon points out wisdom is important. It will save us a lot of hardship. It will save us a lot of going down wrong sort of streets. It will basically give us a proper idea of what God has ordained and to be more content with that. So Solomon points out wisdom is important. Secondly, Solomon points out the world is flawed. Now we know this, don't we? We've known this right from the beginning. It's the heavy burden that God has laid on men. It's the result of the curse. It's Genesis 3. Man's sin has brought him to a point where his life is cursed. That was always going to happen. because that's what God said would happen. After all, Solomon again resorts to the word Hebel here. In this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these. You see, if you want to sort of look at life rationally, if you're going to leave God out of everything, then life will be a perplexing puzzle. It really will be. Solomon notes, he's seen good men have a tough time. And he's seen wicked men doing all right, doing fine. It's the old tension again, isn't it? Do you remember Job and his friends? A bit hard to forget, aren't they? There's Job, suffering. We know what's going on. His friends don't. His friends go for the wisdom of the day. The wisdom of the day said, Job, you must have done something wicked. So God is punishing you. Let's give you, I'll tell you what, we encourage you. No wonder he called them miserable comforters. We're encouraging you by telling all the ways that God punishes the wicked. So they give a long list of what God does and how the wicked never prosper in anything. And Job basically, to paraphrase, says, are you kidding? The wicked have it easy. They're fine. They do all right. No one ever troubles them. They get away literally with murder. Their goods increase. They see their children. They see their grandchildren. Everything goes on and they don't seem to touch again. They basically say to God, leave us alone, and nothing happens. Solomon sees the same, doesn't he? The world doesn't look fair. Actually, it isn't fair because it's a Genesis 3 world. It's a fallen world. You'd expect it to be damaged. Life is vanity, after all, if that's the case. If we're going to try and navigate life and say we can make the best of Genesis 3 world, then actually we're seriously deluded. We won't get anywhere. Job, it's interesting to note that Job's friends sometimes use the word we. And the we means the wisdom literature, the wisdom teachers of the day. And here's a little example. This is quite a difficult part to translate, 16 to 18. But let's have a look at it in detail. Our thinking, basically, what he's saying is our thinking is flawed. In verse 16, there's a reflective verb. And so what probably we should read this as is that it should read, do not rely. Do not rely on being over righteous. Neither be over wise. Do not rely on your wisdom in the end. Don't rely on your own cleverness to try and navigate life. One of the rather interesting things I've noted some years ago, I remember reading The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, and then I read a load of other stuff which people had written about it, not necessarily Christians, other atheists. One of the things, the big debate going on in sort of the radical atheism was, had actually Richard Dawkins done anyone a favour by trying to be sort of the common man's atheist? Because all these other atheists said he's dumbed down the argument. He's not done justice to the argument. And this is interesting, isn't it? People on the same sides can't agree. You see, that's human wisdom, isn't it? Human wisdom always gets confused. It always gets distorted. Now, Solomon is not saying, and this is a problem where the Hebrew is much more detailed, Solomon is not saying that there's a choice of, you know, moderation here. He's not saying, well, it's better not to be too holy or it's better not to be too this or too that. What he is saying is don't be fooled by that kind of thinking. You know, one of the things that I think is very common today is the idea, the ideal for life is moderation, isn't it? You have moderate views on everything. You certainly cannot be too extreme. Just take, this is interesting, I think, because this is something that's shifted in recent years. Just take the arguments on abortion now. You know, we would have stood up 20 years ago and say we have a justifiable sort of argument being pro-life. That's not the way it's being portrayed in the media now, is it? Not at all. The moderate view has been, well, no, it's all about choice. It's now shifted. And someone says, well, don't rely on that moderate view. Because in the end, you must avoid that. Now, verse 18 is tricky. I think a better... I spent a bit of time looking at this. But what Solomon seems to be saying is fear God. And I'm going to take the ESV translation here. And it roughly goes like this. For the one who fears God should come out from both of them. In other words, the one who fears God will reject this idea of being, don't be over wicked, don't be over righteous. So in the end, it's saying, don't rely on human wisdom. Look to God's wisdom. And there's real, real benefits in that. Wisdom comes from God and it has real value. Just look at verse 19. Wisdom makes one wise man more powerful than 10 rulers in a city. God's wisdom is really worth having. It's better than any amount of power that can be sort of dished out or shared around, isn't it? In the end, to clarify his argument, the world is flawed. There's not a righteous man on earth. There's no one who does right and never sins. So we cannot look to our own wisdom. In the end, we have to look to God's. So someone points out the world is flawed, and then he takes us to a natural conclusion, which is he's started in verse 20. We are flawed. Solomon points out we are very, very flawed. And he gives an interesting little example. Verse 21, do not pay attention to every word people say, or you may hear your servant cursing you. For you know in your heart that many times you yourself have cursed others. Charles Haddon Spurgeon used to have his times when he lectured his students. We've got it all written down in a wonderful book called Lectures to My Students. And he notes in this bit of wisdom here, he said, you cannot stop people's tongues. Therefore, the best thing to do is to stop your own ears and never mind what is spoken. Now, I have found that to be extremely good advice. Because I'm aware a lot of times people say things they don't mean or they say them in passing. And, you know, one of the things you do as a minister or as a person, you tie yourself in knots if you try to spend all your time working out what they're saying. Because you'll probably come to the wrong conclusion anyway, won't you? You see, the trouble is, if we harbour stuff about ourselves and get very self-righteous about it, we know we've done the same, verse 22. We're just as guilty. Better to test it by wisdom. You see, we can try and follow wisdom, and Solomon says, well, that's what I've been trying to do. I am determined to be wise, 23, but this was beyond me. There's a real problem here, isn't there? He realizes that wisdom, true wisdom, wisdom that really counts, comes from God. And he, as a mortal man, does not possess it. He tries to seek it out. Verse 25. It's difficult. There's distractions. Verse 26, I find more bitter than death the woman who is a snare, whose heart is a trap, whose hands are chains. The man who pleases God will escape her, but the sinner she will ensnare. Solomon knew a lot about women. Well, I don't know whether he knew a lot about women. He certainly spent a lot of time around women. He had 1,000 wives and concubines, so he must have picked something up. But we also know this, don't we? Solomon found women a big distraction. 1 Kings 11, 3 to verse 8. His wives distracted him. And he sought their gods. He sort of tolerated the worship of their gods. They worshipped many gods, these foreign women, but he loved them, so, you know. It had its difficulty. It actually led to real issues for him as a king and for the kingdom. Because his heart departed from serving the Lord exclusively. We were once asked at college to write a synopsis or sort of summing up of Ecclesiastes. And my argument was, which fortunately my lecturer seemed to think there might be some value in, it's good he had a similar sense of humour to mine, was that after a hard night's partying, Solomon woke up and had, as those alcoholics often call, a moment of clarity, where he looked and surveyed. And he looked at his life and he looked at all this and he said, I've made some mistakes. And the book of Ecclesiastes was written. Possibly, don't know. But the point is this, isn't it? The point is, women for him were a big distraction. I don't think this is anti-women, this bit at all. The wisdom literature, particularly Proverbs, has plenty to say about strange women. Because it realizes a man's weakness. In the end, he realizes that no one is upright in their heart. It's almost as if he says in verse 27 to 28, let me clarify this. Now, again, I think ESV is better here. I think what they tried to do is try to sort of clarify or clear the text by putting in this word upright in black brackets, and it's not in the original. What it's saying is that it's impossible to find an upright man. It's impossible to find an upright woman. I don't think it's particularly saying women are worse than men in that sense. If you read it without the upright, it reads very differently. I have not found one man among 1,000. But not one woman among them all. And his conclusion is very simple. Verse 29. God made man upright, but we've got a problem because Genesis 3 has got in the way. And mankind has sinned and fallen. And everything's now messed up and distorted. And verse 28 is really, it's like a hyperbole. It's basically saying, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. You cannot find righteousness in people. Well, what's this supposed to point us to? We're supposed to point us to the fact that we fail drastically. It points us to the fact that wisdom is important. It points us to the fact the world is flawed. It points out we are flawed and therefore our wisdom is flawed. But there is a way. In Romans chapter 5, we read in verse 18, Paul says this, consequently, just as a result of one trespass was condemnation for all men, so also the result of one act of righteousness was justification that brings life for all men. For just as though through the disobedience of the one man, many were made sinners. So through the obedience of one man, many will be made righteous. And the point is this. In Jesus Christ, we see righteousness, and therefore we see perfect wisdom. And in God, we see the wisdom of the cross. We see the wisdom and logic of Christ becoming a curse for us. Our sin Adam's sin has tainted us. We are born into sin. We fail drastically. But Jesus Christ, the second Adam, what Adam should have been, making the choices that Adam should have made, gives a righteousness to all. We've been given a righteousness of God, 2 Corinthians 5:21. We will try and navigate life, but if we do it with man's wisdom, we will end up all over the place. In the end, we look to the wisdom of God. And that wisdom meant that one man became the perfect sacrifice for the sin of an ancestor and for our sins that are imputed upon us because of that. Rather, now we can be given a righteousness of God. We can have that imputed righteousness of Christ. And once we accept that and once we turn to that, we can actually find true wisdom. True wisdom is found in the cross of Christ, because it means we admit to what we actually are. I realize we cannot rectify it, but we look to the one who can and receive grace and salvation. Let's pray.